Yeah.
All right, thanks. Committee on the Judiciary come to order. Today is March 4th, 2009. First item on the agenda today is a hearing possible work session on House Bill 2541. As Representative Thatcher.
We planned this.
Please go ahead.
Oh, okay. I guess I'll go first. I'm Representative Kim Thatcher from Kaiser St. Paul in Newburgh. And I started working on this particular legislation almost a year ago when my constituent, Craig Cox, came to me and asked for help in stopping repeat drunk drivers. Craig is here today. He will tell his story along with his daughter, Vicky. And we're providing you with a packet. I don't know if you have it yet, but it looks like this. Law enforcement, prosecutors, advocates, and other interested citizens. I was going to point out a couple things in the letter, but you don't have it in front of you, so I'll pause a moment. Thank you. There's a letter from District Attorney Bradley Berry, and it looks like this. It's near the beginning. And he talks, I had some things highlighted in there, and he talks about acknowledging that some of the people who are out there will always find a way around the law no matter what we do, so we know that, but this bill would help reduce their access to alcohol. Local attorney Keith Swanson has a letter also, and along with Newburgh Police Chief Brian Casey, they talk about how it gives merchants the tools to stop these irresponsible people, and it sends a message that Oregonians don't want chronic drunk drivers and reduce their means of doing it, driving drunk, that is. There are several great letters of support, and I'm hoping that as the testimony on this moves forward, that maybe you'd thumb through and look at some of the letters that are in there. But one I would like to point out is at the very last page of the packet. It's from the state of Oregon. It was the latest information we could find on how many people this law would affect, and it's dated 2006. It's a report on DUIs, and it shows that there would probably be around 2,000 drivers impacted by this law each year, and that's out of how many drivers do we have in Oregon? A couple million. So before the opponents get up here to tell you all the things that are wrong with this bill, let me say that we are totally open to looking at amendments. For example, maybe perhaps changing the mechanism used to flag chronic drunk drivers. Instead of using a watermark or sticker on the back of a driver's license, there's other options to consider. In some states, they issue driver's licenses in vertical form for people who are underage, for instance, and they would be disqualified for buying alcohol. Maybe something like that could apply in this case. Back in the 60s and 70s in Oregon, some of you may remember, they had a special card issued by the OLCC to people who were of legal age to drink. It was essentially a permission to buy alcohol card. And then talking to longtime OLCC guy Phil Lang, he remembers at the time it cost around $1. Maybe we can do a modernized version of that card, something like the Oregon Trail card, where it can be swiped in a card reading machine or a phone call can be made or something. Also, in the past, Oregon has used zebra stripe stickers on license plates. That was as late as the early 90s to designate people who had their driver's license suspended. Anyway, my point is we've used different ways and means of red flagging dangerous drivers in the past, and we should be able to do something again to prevent tragedies like the one you'll hear from Craig in a minute. And with that, I apologize. I have to run to another committee, but if you have a question for me, I'm happy to answer. Otherwise, I do have staff here that can help.
Just real quick. Yes. Okay, if we just brand them on the forehead. Yes or no? Are you serious? It'd be a lot easier for the officers when they stop them. All right, just kidding.
Okay. I don't think you were, Representative.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chip Shields. I'm a state representative from District 43 and was delighted that Representative Thatcher has joined in this, I think, with a building movement to simply call this question. Is drinking a privilege or is drinking a right? And why is it in this country that we treat driving as a privilege, but we treat drinking as an absolute right? So what is it that we say to drunks? Well, look, hey, it's okay for you to drive. It's okay for you to drink. But just don't drink and drive. Now, we know that you can't handle your liquor, and you can't act responsibly about it. So we want you to make good decisions when you're all liquored up about whether or not you should drive. Doesn't it make a little bit more sense to say, if you're going to act irresponsibly twice, endangering other people's lives, that we're going to begin to treat booze like a privilege? And what we're really trying to get at in this bill is, you know, the person that shows up at a tavern at 7 in the morning is drinking Boilermakers all day and then is going to have to drive home at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And you know, that's really, I think, what we're trying to do, make it a little bit more difficult for people to get alcohol, to sit on a bar stool all day, and stumble out to their car, and endanger innocent people. This bill was brought to me by Hugh Gray of Big City Produce, who you might remember from when you were patrolling my district in the old days, Representative Barker. And he'll come up and he'll testify about how he brought this idea to me back in 2005. And at first, I didn't quite know what to make of it, but the more and more I thought about it, it just doesn't make any sense that somebody that has 6 or 7 DUIs can walk into any tavern, throw their car keys on the bar, look at the bartender square in the eye and says, you know, pour me 5 shots of whiskey. So I think this will help get in the way of that. We do have some amendments if the committee does decide to move forward, and I'm sure it'll have a fiscal, so you would probably want to just pass this on to Ways and Means, keep it alive. And I think this is kind of a long-term conversation. I'm not sure that we can get this through the building both times, but last time we had a hearing in transportation, now we're exposing more and more people, and I'm really encouraged that this is a very bipartisan issue, that no matter how you stand on all kinds of criminal justice issues, it just makes good sense. So thank you very much for your consideration of this bill.
Thank you. My name is Craig Cox. I live in Newburgh, Oregon. Representative Barker, I appreciate you giving us this time. I'll try to do this without weeping. As a state, I feel that we need to take a step forward. And as you will read in the letters, we weren't only hit one time, we were hit twice. My wife suffered massive brain injuries and seizures. We fought for 27 years. We finally tried a new thing. She said that she didn't want to be here anymore because what conversation was a very trying thing on the brain to process conversation and getting responses. So my daughter would always have Christmas and all that, and I'd have to take her home early. We did everything in our power to keep from having these seizures. The part of the brain that was damaged was her breathing. So every time she had a seizure, she died. So we had to keep her breathing. That was basically what it boiled down to. We tried everything possible. Finally, she said on the last seizure that if she couldn't talk with her family, visit with friends, she didn't want to be here anymore. Well, we had read and heard about a thing called VNS, it's vagus nerve stimulator. It was originally designed for epileptic children. And what it is an electrical implant that they put in the right above the right breast, and they run a wire under the skin, and it's a risky operation, to say the least, and they wrap this wire around the vagus nerve that goes to the brain. This device triggers every 5 minutes. It sends a trigger of voltage, and it can be adjusted by the intensity. And what we had was 2 settings. One was for just a normal, so it didn't clamp her jaw. But if she was having a seizure, if she was to have a seizure, she could hit it again, hit the button again, just push on your chest. She had a magnet that she'd run across it, and it worked. Well, needless to say, as I tried to put all this together, like she said when in the hot tub just prior to the death, it's kind of ironic is that we had a full year with this, and we managed to travel and see all the national parks this last year, which is, I can't tell you what a blessing. Anyway, The guy that hit us the first time, he had 5 DUIs, killed my bookkeeper, who was driving, was in the front seat, Dixie Reddick, and her husband's legs were smashed. I had my shoulder smashed. I have a stainless steel one now. And my wife had these major brain injuries. But anyway, we fought through all of that, and then we get this guy that hits us. We were his 7th DUI. He'd been deported once. He'd even changed letters in his name so they couldn't track him. I mean, they knew how to play the game. But if he wasn't able to buy alcohol just because he's over 21, should not be the criteria. And I don't see nowadays when you have to go to the airport and take your shoes off, if there's not a better time to have some identification of some sort, whatever it be. And like I said, we're open to it. We suggested just a sticker on the back of the license, which I thought would be minimal cost, because we're not going to go backwards. We're only going to go forward. It's only the ones that have got 2 from this point forward. But if we can stop some of them, or most of them, from buying the alcohol and just walking in without any concern, I think it would help immensely, because their judgment definitely is impaired when they drink. So they go get more, just like this guy did. I don't know how many shots he had. But anyway, let's see, is there anything else that I kind of tried to just skim over it. But basically I put, when we were in Judge Tricor's court, and that's another thing, it took 5 months of sitting there every other week while this guy kept messing with the system so that he didn't have to come to trial. I talked to the assistant district attorney, and Mr. Bradbury went ahead and we said, we're pulling his plug. His plea deal is over. If he doesn't accept it the way it is now, we're going to trial. I couldn't do it any longer, and neither could my daughter and my son. So basically, they gave him 15 years. We get the privilege of paying for his care for the next 15 years. So Judge Tricor said, as far as he's concerned, this was not an accident. It was basically murder. Because he went out and drank and drank and drank and drank. We just didn't know who he was going to murder. And he says the law doesn't allow him to sentence people to life, but if he could, he would. And that's what his exact words. So I thank you very much for your time. And I don't know if this is a part of the problem, but I know that fines don't work. Not totally, because it doesn't get their attention. Even sending them back doesn't make any difference. So, and as I sat for the last 3 meetings, you guys giving testimony in regards to the BA going up, from 0.14 to 0.15, 0.16, now we're going to point, wherever. But obviously the fines aren't controlling it. And that's my point, is we need another step in the system to break this train. And I thought, being there's this much inconvenience at the airport, and people accept that on a safety basis without any problem. Yeah. What is so hard about showing a card or a license? I don't believe that it should be. And we just got an amendment that said that the markets could be excluded. I don't know. I mean, there's going to be lots. But all I know is that I feel deeply in my heart that something needs to be done. And I'm not here for sympathy. I promise you that. I'm here if we can make a difference.
Appreciate that. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Hi, my name is Vicki Peterson. I also live in New York. I am the daughter of Craig and Judy Cox. I am here in support of HB 2541. We have a sad story, but the sad part to me is not just our story. There's lots of stories across Oregon with the same issues, and it's not someone who just made a mistake, drank a little too much one night. That's not what we're dealing with. We're dealing with people who chronically, habitually drink and drive. It's, like you said, they know how to play the game. They know how to get through the system. They know how to keep doing it over and over again. The first time, my mom always said she refused to be a victim. So we never called it a crash. It was always since the accident, since the accident. She couldn't read. She couldn't retain what she kept because she'd taken so many medications. My mom could not drink alcohol because of the medication she took. She couldn't have a glass of champagne on New Year's Eve. She couldn't have a glass of wine at Christmas. Yet the individual that took her life could walk in anywhere and buy alcohol as much as he wanted and drink as much as he wants. So... it just seems, you take out your debit card every day at the grocery store when you make purchases. We all do it now. We don't write checks. We do debit cards. I don't see what the issue would be to take out your license if it could save one life. To watch what this has done to my dad is, there's no words. There's just no words. So I really appreciate all the legislation you guys have done, because we have been here and we've been keeping up on this since this has happened. And I know that you guys have been working really hard to get punishments in place to maybe to prevent some of these things from happening. And I agree, the more the better. I'm all about that. But it seems like maybe we could kind of, maybe Oregon could be at the forefront of maybe a preventative measure. So maybe we could keep these things from happening. So, again, I thank you for your time and all your effort that you do here. It's very much appreciated.
And thank you very much for your coming and telling us your personal story. I know that how difficult that can be, and it's important. It helps us to see it instead of just reading something, to see the human beings involved in it.
Thank you.
We understand that. Is there any questions, this panel? Thank you very much. I'm sorry.
I haven't written or entered some written testimony, but I would like to speak quickly.
Please.
My name is Andrew Cox, the son of Craig and Judy, and I'm also for House Bill 2541. A little bit of an economic picture. Every time my mom had a seizure, it was normally between $5,000 and $50,000. Okay, that happened over 27 years. The amount of money my father and my mother paid to deal with this accident is amazing. Okay, and not file bankruptcy, continue to stay in the game and make it work. Finding a citizen such as Miranda, as not a citizen, but as an illegal national here, 3 to 6 times his national income has not deterred that behavior whatsoever. I mean, his annual income, sorry, not national. Okay, but this bill gives the citizens of Oregon a chance to start to police ourselves as opposed to litigate and legislate. We can start to take a look at it and watch for ourselves about what's going on as merchants of the of alcohol, but also as merchants as when you're having parties at your houses. This is about watching out for ourselves and beginning to take ourselves out of harm's way. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Hugh Gray and Lana Colley.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. However you want to do it, but be sure to identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, my name is Hugh Gray, and I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 2541. There's also a Senate Bill 279 I would like you guys to maybe look up and read as well. I don't know who it's sponsored by. I can tell you here in a second. Should have been ready.
Representative Thatcher and Senator
by,
Courtney.
Courtney and Thatcher. Okay. You already know. All right. Well, my name is Hugh Gray. I'm here, and I'm a concerned citizen of Oregon. I'm 56 years old. I've been a resident of Oregon since 1978. I've been married to my wife, Cindy, for 25 years, raised a blended family of 6 children, and I have 6 grandchildren. I've owned and managed grocery stores, produce stores, and I've been in the retail business for 39 years. I've also owned and operated a restaurant and managed a liquor store in California. So I think I have a full life experience with people in the retail sector. In 2004, my business, Big City Produce, won the best award from the City of Portland for best sustainable food system for providing culturally appropriate food to an underserved population. My life's experience has formed my opinion of this bill. I think it's a no-brainer. We believe it will eliminate up to 20% of the traffic deaths and injuries caused by under the influence drivers, and that's huge. On a personal note, I've been struck by a drunk driver myself. I stopped for a red light. A gentleman ran into the back of my pickup and pushed the bed of my pickup to the cab. Thankfully, I was young at the time, and I didn't sustain any major injuries. My wife's been hit by drunk drivers twice when we lived at the coast. She's stopped on Elk River Road on Highway 101 and rear-ended not once but twice by drunk drivers, and thankfully there again she was young and didn't sustain any major injuries. But a few years ago, one of my employees, Larry Needham, and 3 of his friends, Orion Statushek, Carolyn Buchhalter, and Angela Lansbury, were in Portland riding on a late night, summer's night, it was really warm, and coming home from Mount Tabor, when a drunk driver, Lindsay Lanza, I can't pronounce his name, Lineza, He had several DUI convictions, just left the bar, barreling down the road on a side street, going over 50 miles an hour, and plowed into all these bicyclists. Orion was killed, Angelo was killed, Caroline was severely injured, and Larry, my employee, was missed. And, you know, the devastation that it caused in the community where my store was overwhelming. It was a young community of musicians and artists, and, you know, if any of you guys have been to Portland and been to the Mississippi District where my store was, you can see what's been happening there, and it's that young crowd. I call them the No Drink Tattooed Kids, but it totally devastated that whole community. And Angela's parents came to me and with this bill, and I passed it on to Margaret Carter, and she passed it on to Chip, who took her position in the house. And, you know, we've been working on this ever since. And on a more personal basis, my eldest stepson, Michael, OD'd on heroin in 2004. He started with alcohol, and he was in rehab three times. He lost his family. He lost his kids. You know, this bill would have kept him out of the bars, at least, and maybe gave him some kind of incentive, you know, to stop. But he never stopped. He was homeless, and I had to identify his body in a body bag. And, you know, I don't wish this on anybody. You know, so these are the type of things that perhaps it could stop. You know, we all know that prohibition failed, but these bills are a tool to help reduce the fatalities and give the rehab counselors some tool with some teeth to it. I mean, I know, you know, I have another stepson who has an alcohol problem, and he is right now going through diversion classes, and he hates the fact that I'm here. But I know that this would keep him out of the bars, and that's his biggest problem. And whether he's driving or not, it would help him in his recovery. And I think that's the other issue that we have to look at here. You know, we're not stupid. We know the guys are going to get alcohol somewhere, but, you know, this can help keep them out of there. Having been in the retail business for as long as I have, I completely understand the concerns of those who lobby against it. You know, translates to dollars and cents. How long will it take the customers to get through the checkout stand? And that's going to translate to time and how much they figure these things incrementally into how long it takes to move people through the check stand and how much it costs to do that. You know, so then, you know, how is it going to affect their bottom line? And then tavern and restaurant owners are going to be concerned, are they going to lose business because they're not selling alcohol? You know, but the bottom line is that we're going to be saving lives and improving lives. And this is an issue that affects every family in Oregon. I mean, there's no doubt about it. That everybody here has probably known somebody who's been affected by this issue. It's something that doesn't go away. I mean, and like Chip said earlier, you know, this drinking isn't a privilege, or right, excuse me, it is a privilege, you know, and it's something that we don't have to let people do all the time, and this may stop some of it. Also, I have a letter here from Angela's parents, Kenny and Judy Franklin, and I don't want to read the whole thing, but there's a couple passages, and you guys should have copies of it as well. It says this Senate bill, which is a House bill, is not intended to penalize people using alcohol responsibly, nor those businesses that serve them. Nevertheless, the gravity of the problem and the millions of lives affected make addressing this matter an urgent concern for all of us. The number of such incidents must be dramatically and permanently reduced as soon as possible. We as parents who lost our daughter to a repeat drunk driver ask you, the committee, to read over House Bill 2541. Let it grow unto you as it has done to so many others. With the realization that House Bill 2541 can work effectively, and most importantly, it can and will save lives. We have changed law after law when it comes to drunk driving, but the problem stands that the new laws are formed from and follow previous law standards. House Bill 2541 holds it to new substance and a positive weight with it, in which has never been put into place. Oh, I'm sorry. Being life-ending reality caused by drunk driving. Most importantly, previously convicted drunk drivers in our society would be unable to purchase alcohol in local establishments with the revoking of their alcohol ID card. This will lessen their need to drive, knowing that they will not be served alcohol in public. That right there will no doubt save life. Excuse me. We stand by them who have come in front of you today and ask that you enact on and pass House Bill 2541. Let it be a stepping stone we so greatly need in today's world. I think the electorate voted for change in this country in this last election. and I think now is the time to change these laws for the safety of the citizens of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think it could have a positive effect on people who aren't chronic drinkers when they have to show their identification to show they don't have that. It just might help ring a bell in them to
take,
be careful.
And it takes the responsibility away from the checker and the check stand and the waitress or bartender. Everybody has to show their ID when they come in.
Yeah.
Everybody. So it's just rote. People just come and start doing it. And, you know, as having been in the check stand myself over the years, you know, you're sitting there going, God, is this guy 21? Is he not 21? Oh, I got 10 people in line here. Well, you know, I better just move ahead. You know, this way it takes all that decision making away from the check stand. You know, they're just doing it.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lana Cully, and I'm the DMV Program Services Manager. You have my written testimony before you, so there was just a couple other points that I wanted to bring out in the testimony. First, although the bill requires the driver's license and the ID card to be canceled and then surrendered by the person when the court has ordered us to place the alcohol restriction on their license, many times that license or that ID card is not surrendered to us. The person will say they've lost it or whatever, and it does not get surrendered to us, so they would have that in their possession still. Or if they have their driver's license confiscated by law enforcement when they're arrested for the DUI, they can go into DMV and get an ID card to use as identification for cashing checks or whatever, and they could do that before that order is received by us, so it would not have that restriction on it. So that's another form for them to continue to use to purchase alcohol without the restriction on it. In addition, the bill still allows for people to use other types of IDs, such as a passport, that would not have the restriction on it. The other thing I want to mention is there is limited space available on our driver's license and ID cards. Although it appears that there could be a lot of white space on the back, there are several endorsements and restrictions that could be put on a license. So, and they are, the print is quite small, just to be aware of. And then lastly, I just wanted to bring up that there is a fiscal impact with this bill. And due to the considerable amount of programming to change our system to keep that information on the record and then place it on the driver's license or ID card, we would not be able to implement this by the January 2010 date that's required in the bill. So we would ask for that at least to be amended. And I will conclude with that.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Stigler?
More by way of a comment. I mean, Ms. Cully, I appreciate the fiscal impact, the issue of the fiscal impact that you pointed out, and that's really that and perhaps limited space, though I always think where there's a will, there's a way. That's really the only issues that you raise in your written or oral testimony that directly impacts DMV, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Stigler, yes, that is correct.
Right, and I guess I would sort of thank you, and you might not think it's a thank you, but for pointing out the issues regarding the surrender of the license, the ID card, and or the possibility of use by of another form of identification. I guess I would submit to this committee that those are not insurmountable issues, and those are things that I can think of several creative ways to deal with those, such as requiring that the license and or ID card, if one has, and those are easy to check out, whether one an ID card's been issued after confiscation, that's on record with DMV, so it would be quite easy to determine if one or the other is in the possession of the offender and require that those be surrendered at the time of the criminal proceedings. And I think that would be one way that we could deal with this. And there may be some other ways. And but I just want to be real clear that really the only thing impacting DMV directly is the fiscal impact and the logistical aspects of the reissuance.
In Oregon, after your third, you don't have a driver's license. So, anyway, thank you very much, Representative Shields.
Ms. Cully, I just want to thank you very much for very constructive input into how we can make this bill better. I much appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll close before I close the public hearing, we'll continue to work on this and take a look at some amendments and see what we can. If we could come up with a workable solution in parts, and I'll work with Representative Shields. We have some retired law enforcement up here, in front who are interested in this topic, so we'll keep working at it. Thank you very much for the testimony today. Close the hearing on House Bill 2541 and open a hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2536.
House Bill 2536 expands robbery in the first degree to include look-alike firearms. It extends disorderly conduct in the first degree to include delivery of an unidentified substance with a threatening message, and expands felon in possession of a restricted weapon to include taser and pepper spray. We do not yet have the fiscal impact statement on this.
Chief Sean, Captain Coons, Cindy Robert, and Bob, we'll go ahead with that first.
With your permission, Cindy Robert left. If you
okay.
Don't mind if I set him
please.
In place.
Please do.
Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Kevin Campbell. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and we're here today to support House Bill 2536. Just in way of brief background, Cindy, I know you'd prefer to hear from her, but with her absence, I'll do my best to outline briefly the reason we're bringing this bill forward. The City of Medford and the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police are working together to forward this bill. It basically, we call it kind of anecdotally the Modern Crimes Bill, and our goal is to take areas in the law, the criminal law, that we believe are either emerging trends or technology advancements that are creating the need for the criminal justice system to make an adjustment moving forward. And so there are three different concepts contained in the bill. I think counsel already mentioned them. We're going to be going in greater detail today. I have a couple folks here today. Chief Randy Schoen to my left, Chief of Police for the City of Medford here is here. Captain Jeff Coons from the Kaiser Police Department is also here, and they're each going to cover different aspects of the bill that's before you today. And so, Mr. Chair, the committee, I'll turn it at this point over to them, and they'll talk about detail. And then if there are any questions, I'll have Cindy come up, too, in case she'd like to join us.
Thank you. Go ahead, Chief.
Chairman Barker, committee members, for the record, my name is Randy Schoen. I'm the Chief of Police for Medford, Oregon. First, I wanted to talk about the proposal on robbery in the first degree about adding use of look-alike firearms to that element. This statute change, from our view, addresses the mindset and perspective of the victim whom will be reporting this offense as having occurred with a weapon. The victim faces the terror and the fear and the trauma as if this was a weapon. The victim will behave as if it's a weapon, they'll report it as if it is a weapon, and law enforcement will respond as if it is a weapon. And should law enforcement come in contact with this person and they attempt to use or display the weapon in a manner to try to aid their escape or to menace those attempting to apprehend them, a deadly force would be used. Medford has had robberies involving use of pellet guns, and Captain Coons will be talking about his display here. And so we have had armed robberies using weapons that are similar, look like weapons that look like the ones on display here. Oftentimes, these arrests of the suspects occur weeks, months later, and the firearm is not recovered. And oftentimes in the interview, what they will tell us is that they used a look-alike firearm, knowing that the penalty is enhanced. I apologize that we don't have a fiscal statement on this. We do think that by adding this to first-degree robbery, it does provide opportunities for the prosecuting attorneys to sometimes a plea bargain these things, which at times can also save on costs. But we really think that what the fiscal impact could be is if we could prevent crimes from occurring with firearms and look-alike firearms, then there would be a significant impact. But what that would be, I don't know. The second part that I wanted to talk about, was adding to disorderly conduct in the first degree any time a person mails or effects a delivery of a hoax substance to government or business, and there's a message with that that threatens the receiver's physical safety. Unfortunately, in the post-9/11 world we live in, this is an unfortunate byproduct of that. And hope terror is still domestic terrorism. We believe the state needs to send a message that this will not be tolerated, and it needs to be looked at again from the victim's mindset and the alarm it causes. This event causes a public safety response that ties up assets that are badly needed elsewhere. The response to a hoax terrorism threat still has to be treated as if it was a real event. All precautionary measures have to be taken. Hoax events causes alarm, public inconvenience, and annoyance, and hoax events are a real cost to the taxpayer. Then the last thing I would like to address is our request to include as a prohibited weapon or restricted weapon, the electromuscular disruption technology devices are oftentimes commonly referred to as tasers, as a device that a convicted felon could not possess. Now, these devices are currently being marketed as self-protection tool for the future. They're being sold across the country to mothers and store owners and anyone that wants to make that purchase, with little regulatory oversight on those who make these purchases. Law enforcement that carries these tasers, there's a cycle time on those that are 5 seconds. And if you're not familiar with how they work, it sends out a frequency that's intended to block the frequency of the messages retraveling from your brain throughout your spinal column, so it causes paralysis for the 5 seconds that in which the taser is being administered to you. These devices that are being bought by the public oftentimes have a 30-second cycle time. And the intention of these devices that are being sold to the public is that when they're being used to protect themselves, the probes are shot out, there's a 15-foot range, and it gives the mother, the store owner, a chance to get away and separate themselves from the criminal. They'll call 911 and get help. In the 90s, we saw chemical aerosol restraints were widely being sold as self-defense tools, and we saw those migrate into uses by criminals in robberies and assaults. Our concern is that these devices, tasers type devices, will also find their way into the hands of criminals for criminal enterprises. Currently, it is illegal for a felon to possess a firearm and certain types of restricted weapons, and we would like to have you pursue in moving this device to be included in those restricted weapons. Tasers, as you know, these type of devices have the ability to easily incapacitate. And if used to commit crimes, they increase the level of the potential victimization, especially in the areas of person crimes such as robbery and assault. These devices also have the ability to incapacitate police officers. And as you know, every time we have a contact with somebody, we bring a firearm to that contact. And should these devices be used by felons against police officers, it would facilitate them having access to our firearms. These devices are much more dangerous in the hands of convicted felons who have a tendency to commit other crimes. In Medford, in December of 1995, we had a horrific murder committed by a guy named Robert Ackermont, where he kidnapped and bound and shot two female property managers. In his confession, he talked about how he brought a taser, a stun gun, was one of his tools to commit the crimes, and how he used it on the victim to see how she would react and to see what it was like to administer the stun gun on her. These devices are intended to protect officers and citizens from felons and not to aid felons in the commission of crimes and or to protect themselves from police officers. So we would ask for your consideration into adding this as a device that convicted felons cannot possess. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Cindy Robert, and I'm proud to represent the City of Medford. And I'm sorry I was not here in the opening seconds of this testimony, but I did just want to clarify. I know these two gentlemen have much more important things to say, but the -1 amendments are, in fact, offered by us. We introduced them in an effort to make sure that we answered one of the major concerns that we actually thought was very legitimate, and that's the fact that there are actually felons in our society who are white-collar crime felons, some of which could be women, for example, a woman who has been stealing from her business and is convicted of a felony, and that woman still needs the right to protect herself. And mace was introduced as one of those weapons that they could use and was not as significant in harm to police as some of these other ones. So on the Senate side, Senate Bill 251 made this change, adding taser or electro stun gun to the statute. We talked there in that committee about putting mace in, decided it wasn't a good idea, and subsequently 251 did pass the Senate floor, and so we did offer amendments to make them congruous here.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Coons. I'm a captain with the Kaiser Police Department, and I am here today to testify on behalf of House Bill 2536, on behalf of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and I believe also on behalf of many victims that have been robbed and of several district attorneys who have tried to prosecute these cases. My written testimony has been submitted to you folks, so I would ask that you refer to that at a later point. I'm going to hit some high points in my testimony now. While I support House Bill 2536 in its entirety, I would like to focus on the look-alike firearm portions of that particular bill. So I might second a couple things that Chief Schoen already spoke about. This is an issue that I take very personally and I am very passionate about. As a captain, I could have delegated the making of this board to a subordinate, but I didn't. I was working on it late last night. And each and every one of the guns or replica guns that you folks are looking at right now are guns that I have asked my evidence technician to hold on to during the course of the last 5 or 6 years as we've seen these emerge into the law enforcement world as things that our officers are seeing on the streets. They're seeing them used in robberies and in other places. So I have waited for 3 years to come testify before you. I made a promise back in 2006, January of 2006, when we had a string of four armed robberies in the Salem-Kaiser area, and we located the subject after several months of investigation. We located that subject, identified him, and arrested him and charged him with all four counts of robbery in the first degree. Because during those robberies, instead of pointing a firearm at the victim, he simply showed a firearm that was in his pant pocket, or what was believed to have been a firearm. This individual had served 18 years in the Arizona correction system for committing a robbery in the first degree prior to coming to the Salem-Kaiser area to commit these new four robberies. He learned something in those first robberies. Don't you dare point a firearm and be captured on a videotape because you're going to go down for rob one. So in these cases, what we believe was he simply showed it so it wouldn't be captured on any of the surveillance tapes in any of his businesses. And, of course, he accomplished what he wanted to accomplish. He put the fear of God in these victims, and he walked out of each one of these businesses with money in hand to support his habit. Well, most of the time, we don't catch these people when they run out of the convenience store or the bank. We catch them because they've left a fingerprint, or we put their picture on the news, and somebody calls and says, yeah, I know who that individual is. So we do an awful lot of work. We identify where they live, and we go to their residence, and we serve a search warrant. In this case, we went to that subject's house. We served a search warrant, and the gun that he used, or we believe he used, is the black gun here, second on the left. None of these are real guns, folks. These are all fakes. These are all fakes. But when we did a very diligent search of his home, and that's all we can find, our district attorney could only charge this individual with robbery, too, because that's what he and his defense attorney told the court, was prove it, ladies and gentlemen, prove that that was a real firearm. Well, I'm telling you, the 17-year-old victim at Walgreens, she had the fear of God placed in her. She thought that was a real firearm. Our response, like Chief Schoen testified to earlier, was no different. We drive Code 3, putting you folks and innocent citizens at jeopardy, hoping that our officers clear those intersections safely. We deploy shotguns, we deploy assault rifles, and we unholster our handguns. And so death or serious physical injury still can occur, even if somebody robs a business with a fake gun. Don't let anybody fool you into thinking that it can't. So with that being said, I'm just going to let you know that in the past 20 years, times have changed. I don't know what the original intent was with the original robbery one statute. 20 years ago, when we had a photograph of somebody robbing a bank with a weapon, it was real easy for the district attorney to say, that's a firearm. Today it's not, because you can see what we're left with dealing with. All these, again, are fakes. And on film or in a photograph, you can't prove in a court that it was a fake or a real firearm. So one other thing. I've spoke to a lot of people about this, and Jody Beretta is the deputy district attorney for Marion County. And here's a quote I want to read to her. She says, quote, I can say that in talking to victims of these types of crimes, the impact on the victim is identical, and they do not know that the weapon is not real. Robbery victims where a gun is used, whether it's real or not, are some of the most psychologically damaged victims that I worked with. The incidents of PTSD and those people who can never go back to their jobs because of what happened is very, very high. So in conclusion, there might be some that come up here and argue, folks, this is already covered in the Robbery 2 statute. I'm going to argue that it's not. Robbery 2 says, quote, represents by word or conduct that the person is armed with what purports to be a deadly or dangerous weapon. That's totally different than sticking a gun in somebody's face. That is giving them a note saying that I have a gun, give me your money. That's representing by word or conduct, or this is representing by word or conduct that they have a gun. This is something totally different. When you get one of these put in your face, you're going to believe it's real. With that being said, I ask that you support House Bill 2536 in its entirety, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chief Schoen or Captain Coons, either one of you can answer this question. Actually, I got a series of questions, Mr. Chair. The first question I have for you is, and if you might have discussed this, I didn't catch it, but when a robbery crime does occur, how often after it's been committed is it determined that you have yourself a real firearm versus that of a fake firearm?
Chair Barker and Representative Olson, I would say, in my opinion, it's not very often that we recover the firearm, the fake or the real firearm. So it's very easy. When we do identify the defendant, either through a fingerprint or through other means, most of the time we don't find a firearm, whether it's fake or real. So then it's very easy. Even if we have them on film holding a gun or a fake gun, it's very easy for them to walk in or with their defense attorney to say, prove that that's a real firearm. Our district attorneys can't prove it, folks. They cannot prove it unless we find that on them.
Okay, Mr. Chair. And I guess, Chief Schoen, you alluded to this to some degree in your testimony. How often does a suspect during a robbery all of a sudden point out to the or mention to the victim that they don't have a real gun, that they're actually using a fake gun during the robbery?
Representative Olson, in that scenario, I've never heard of them telling people it's a fake gun. If we can arrest the person within moments of the crime, we oftentimes we'll know, but when we arrest somebody months or weeks or days later and we don't recover the firearm, it frequently they tell us that it was a fake or simulated weapon.
Okay, thank you. And then just one other. Looking at the amendment that you have, the dash one, Cindy, and I see that the bold-faced information is removed. Having been involved with defensive tactics over the years, I know both of you have, and you've seen the results of what pepper spray does, I am actually kind of surprised that that didn't stay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, we would agree with you when we first started drafting it. However, on the other side, particularly from Senator Whitsett, there was some great reasoning and some great examples of people who actually have been convicted of felonies that still need some sort of protection for them and for their children. So it was one of those situations where we did not believe that the actual harm to the police officer, and understand that all of these issues, all of them, whether it's a look-alike weapon or the taser, affects the police officer, and we're not talking as much about the victim, although that certainly is a concern, but we're talking about the level of control in a situation that a criminal has over a police officer. And with pepper spray, it's just not quite as big. Now, my chief will probably argue with me. My chief probably wanted it in there, but I think it was something that we had to agree probably was not to the same degree as a stun gun.
Well, I'd only say that if I have a choice between the two, the stun device is a much larger threat than the pepper spray. I mean, in a perfect world, I'd like both, but...
So you compromise?
And Representative Olson, some of the testimony revolved around a woman who had a felony suspended driver's license at one time, who's not really a violent criminal, but yet needed to be able to protect herself and her children, so that's why they left that in. I want to thank you, Captain, for bringing up the victim, which usually isn't mentioned in, when we're talking about robberies, the effects of being robbed, the people who can't go back to work, the bank tellers, and so on. And something that wasn't addressed that I think is important is should somebody come into a store or should somebody come into this room and try to rob somebody with a fake gun, there may be people with concealed weapons that would end up shooting them on the spot. And that's always a great danger of loss of life, even for the criminal. I mean, where they may think they're in command. If they got a toy gun, it's would be a very bad decision to come up against somebody who had a real gun.
Mr. Chair, can I just comment on that?
Yeah, please.
That's the point that I was trying to make, that if I'm dressed like this at Walgreens, plain clothes, or in this room, somebody does have a CCW, exactly right. If they're not the best shot and they miss the perpetrator, that's where you and I can get caught up in crossfire and be seriously injured or killed. So just because it was a fake gun, don't be fooled that somebody can't be killed, because there are things that can happen.
This issue came up in Portland when somebody grabbed a Max driver and said he was going to hijack the train and was arrested, and some people thought that was pretty funny until somebody pointed out that had somebody else been on the train, it might have ended tragically. So,
yeah.
Mr. Chair, if I might just add again, Cindy Robert, while the firearm issue is certainly a huge one and something that we believe for a long time has been changed, and while the Senate has already forwarded to you a bill that changes and adds taser to a restricted weapon for a felon, the other item in here is, in fact, the mailing or delivery of a substance with a threat note, and that is the only piece that actually isn't already addressed in Oregon, a revised statute. The other two were moving one from a robbery in the second degree to the first degree. The other one we're moving from convicted felon restricted weapon to a Class A misdemeanor. So we're moving those up. They're already addressed. But this issue is not addressed.
Right.
We may be able to extrapolate a disorderly conduct charge from something like this or a public havoc type claim, but it's not the actual substance, delivery of a substance and a threat letter is not addressed anywhere in ORA. So all these crimes, all three are really taking and dealing with modern crimes that are elevated because of technology, and this is one of them. And no one could have imagined the fear or the offense as it could have been established with a powder and a note, but they're there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much. Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Mr. Ellis?
Chair Barker and members of the Judiciary Committee, my name is Kevin Ellis and I work for the Juvenile Rights Project. I'm a staff attorney there, and our organization represents mostly juveniles who are in the foster care system due to abuse or neglect. We also do represent juveniles who are committed, who are being prosecuted for delinquency or crimes that would be punishable, or committing acts that would be punishable as crimes if they were adults. The only issues that I'd like to address today is we have concerns with Section 1 of this bill, which would make it a robbery in the first degree from a robbery in the second degree where it stands now if it's a look-alike gun as opposed to a real gun. A lot of our concerns have to do with the fact that, as we all know, juveniles are less mature than adults, and this bill would raise from right now, if you're charged with robbery in the second degree as a juvenile, there is what's called sort of an escape valve. If you're a first-time offender with no prior record, no prior offenses, no referrals to a juvenile department, you've never done anything before, and we recognize this is a very serious crime, but a 15-year-old with a toy gun who commits this very serious crime today would have the option to not do a mandatory minimum sentence. The result of this this bill would make that 15-year-old serve a mandatory minimum sentence of 90 months in prison, or 90 months with the OIA. We'd also note that that cost for the first-time offender with no prior record would be $318,000. Our biggest concern is this bill actually has the greatest, steepest effect on juveniles that have no prior offenses. What we'd note is a juvenile or a 15-year-old boy with a toy gun would be treated exactly the same, would receive the exact same sentence as a hardened adult criminal with a loaded, deadly firearm. And that is our concern that I'd like to raise with this committee today. We'd also note if anyone age 15 or older is currently convicted or adjudicated of robbery in the second degree, there is a mandatory minimum of 70 months in prison. If they have a prior record, if they have prior referrals, if they're not eligible or allowed to escape from the mandatory minimum sentence, they currently get 70 months. They get committed for 70 months. This bill would only change it from 70 months to 90 months. And my greatest concern and my organization's greatest concern is that juveniles would be overly affected by this bill. So if anyone has any questions, or I'd be happy to address your
concerns. Part of the concern, you know, wasn't, although this certainly is would have that effect, but we're concerned about the adults who are using real guns, loaded guns, ready to kill somebody, who then get caught later and say, oh, I was just fooling, it was a pretend gun, and are thereby working the system. And the other thing that you probably heard me mention, if some 15-year-old is standing with one of those guns there in a restaurant, you know, for carrying out a robbery, and if I'm in there with my wife, he's probably going to die. Hopefully not, you know, but, I mean, so it's a huge thing, and maybe we need to be spending more time educating the younger people, as they did when Measure 11 first came into effect, about what you better not do, because what, you know, seems like fun or, I mean, a rough horseplay or something can really get you into serious, serious trouble. But your point is well taken. Appreciate you. Anybody else? Representative Stigler.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I guess the only thing I have in all of this is characterizing, I think, the issue of whether it's a real weapon or not a real weapon, the whole problem of somebody, no matter what their age, executing what appears to be at least a armed robbery is terribly troubling. I mean, it's an extremely serious departure from normative behavior. I mean, it just is. It's not, and I, don't tell me that the 16-year-old I'm representing doesn't know that if he enters into a drugstore with or the convenience store, the 7-Eleven down the street with a gun and says, give me your money or I'm going to shoot you, that they don't know jolly well what they're doing in that regard, that it's a very serious potentially event. And I understand all the issues, and I think, you know, you've got some valid points here with respect to younger offenders. But I hate this idea that we're characterizing this as hardened criminal. I wouldn't care as an adult offender whether it was the first time they decided they were going to do a robbery or the 10th time. I mean, either way, it has the same potential detrimental impact all the way around.
Questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you very much for thank you for your time.
Well, we can't move this bill out today because we don't have a fiscal. I'm going to close the public hearing and open a work session on 2536, and would accept a moment to move a motion to adopt the dash ones.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett moves the dash ones be adopted into the bill. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Close the work session on House Bill 2536. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2641.
House Bill 2641 modifies the definition of online communication to include the online sexual corruption of child through telephonic text messages. Again, we do not have a fiscal impact statement on this, okay. And there is no amendment.
Okay. And we have a good number of speakers. Okay. Thank you. Representative Olson, do you want to introduce the bill, please?
Three words. I hope you can handle it. But it means a lot.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Andy Olson, and I'm a state representative out of Albany. House Bill 2641 is just a simple little fix to a bill that was passed 2 years ago. And in that, if many of you remember, the online sexual corruption first and second degree that was passed out of here. Well, that bill specifically dealt with online communication. And it didn't go as far as talking about some of the other technology that's out there today. About a year and a half ago, a principal at a high school down in my area, Representative Springer's house district, not mine. Mine's a little cleaner. But anyways, don't share that with her, please.
Just between us.
Thank you.
We won't tell anybody.
Anyways, well, what had happened is that there was a teacher that was texting messages, very graphic, sexual-type messages, to a 16-year-old girl that was a student at the high school. And the elements that were, I mean, if they had been under ORS 163, 431, or 433, you would have had the crime. But the way it was designed, not having a crime involved, you didn't have anything. So basically what happened is it became an administrative function for the school and the school district to deal with the issue. With that, I talked with a number of investigators across the state, and those that are deeply involved in the investigation of sexual crimes, and they felt that this was a piece that we've dubbed now as sex texting would be really critical to help in enforcing that issue. And if you, I mean, for all those of you who do have a cell phone, you know how easy it is to send messages as well as photographs. So that this would be a nice piece to add to the law that exists right now.
And Mr. Perry, you can come up also. Go ahead, Mr.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, I am Brad Berry. I'm the Yamhill County District Attorney, and I chair the Oregon District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee. House Bill 2641, from our review initially as it came before the committee, was really a housekeeping measure. We recognized that, 2 years ago, as Representative Olson mentioned, there were a lot of bills that dealt with online sexual corruption aimed at minors in particular, and it's not uncommon that as technology changes or the use of certain types of technology increases, we find that people, even unintentionally, tend to use different types of technology that were omitted from a bill or just not thought about. As Representative Olson mentioned, sex texting is commonplace from our perspective. We have, in fact, in my county, had individuals arrested in the catch-a-predator type of behavior that you're probably familiar with, and in fact, we have had situations where those individuals have moved from online communication to getting the cell phone number for the potential victim, and the communication continues in writing by texting with that particular individual. And if you recall the difference between one level, you know, first degree and second degree, it has to do with actual luring them, making them move from one place to another, and it is certainly not uncommon that it would begin on the computer and as the location is communicated from the predator to the victim, typically a minor, or a minor in all these, that in fact it would continue to communicate through a cell phone by text messaging. So really, again, I see this as housekeeping. It continues to do exactly what you intended to do last time, protect minors from this type of predator.
Questions, Representative Krieger. Line 8 and 9, or any other method communicating over the internet, what would happen if you put, or any other type of device? In other words, we don't know what's coming in the future. We never thought about text messaging years ago. You might be able to keep us from coming back in a few years and have to adding something that we didn't understand was coming up.
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, I'm going to go now on some of my own experience in my county where we've made changes to restraining orders, domestic violence restraining orders, to incorporate what the state adopted form didn't cover, and we have added, for example, text messaging on those or other electronic communications on those, and that has been an attempt to try and capture whatever we're not thinking of, candidly. And so I think the short answer is yes, if we had something there that was broader, my expectation is they will all be electronic in some fashion. But I can tell you that I actually argued that no telephone contact, a prohibition and a restraining order, included text messaging before we got the forms changed to specifically include that. So we're always out there trying to achieve what the law is attempting to protect and recognizing that we may have some changes in the actual tool used by the individual violating the law.
Okay, thank you. Representative Stigler.
Two things, and this is just an FYI. I have a bill that has just come out, and one of the things it has to do with harassment and electronic harassment, and there is a definition in it that's a broader definition of electronic communication. So what I'd suggest is that when that bill comes before us, we make sure that the two definitions are in concert so that we don't have conflicting definitions somewhere. So I don't remember the number. But secondly, Representative Olson, you've never seen me try to text. It's not an easy feat.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm thankful for that.
It's painful.
Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
And close the public hearing on House Bill 2641. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2529.
House Bill 2529 modifies the procedure for impounding a fighting bird during an investigation for criminal mistreatment, authorizes an officer to apply for a search warrant and impound animals in cases involving animal fighting, requires a person convicted of sexual assault of an animal to report as a sex offender. We do not yet have the fiscal impact statement on this.
I won't do this already.
And there is a dash-one amendment.
Okay. Scott Heiser and Sharon Harmon, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott Heiser. I'm an attorney with the Animal Legal Defense Fund and a former prosecutor here in Oregon with about 17 years in the trenches before I joined the Animal Legal Defense Fund. My job with ALDF is to provide prosecution assistance with animal cruelty cases in Oregon and around the nation. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2529. This bill was dropped by Representative Gelser and Witt at my request, and I'm grateful to them for doing that. And what this bill does is two things. One, it fills a loophole. It prevents a loophole from being exploited by people who engage in animal fighting and allows for the pre-conviction forfeiture of those animals that are seized in an animal fighting investigation so that those dogs don't, or those birds most commonly, don't languish in shelters or foster care placement providers' homes for months, if not years, while the case drags on. So that's a huge improvement in the law and is currently being applied successfully in Oregon with the passage of Measure 53 and other forms of animal cruelty, including sexual abuse of animals. The second thing this bill would do, omitting comment on the Dash 1 amendments at this point in time, is address sexual abuse of animals, people engaging in sexual contact with animals, either dead or alive. It's a crime in Oregon, and it's a good law that we have, but when somebody does engage in that conduct and they're convicted of it, they're not required to register as a sex offender. The body of literature out there suggests strongly that people that engage in that form of violence are 5 times more likely to reoffend against other human victims. So, with an eye towards preventative medicine, it makes sense that we ought to have those offenders register so they can be tracked, monitored, and treated in the community. So, while I appreciate that the fiscal times are tight in Oregon and that there may be a fiscal associated with the sex offender registration component to this bill, I'd strongly urge you to reconsider or consider not striking that language from the proposed statute and adopt that fix, because there aren't that many cases, frankly, less than 10 a year in Oregon, that involve people that engage in sexual conduct with animals. 2 this year so far that I'm aware of, one in Douglas County and one in the metro area. So that's my comment. I'm going to turn it over to Sharon at this point in time.
Okay. Representative Barker, members of the committee, I'm Sharon Harmon. I'm an executive director of the Oregon Humane Society. We are a local Oregon animal welfare advocacy and animal shelter organization. We're not affiliated with any national or other local entity. We work very closely with the Animal Legal Defense Fund. They provide the attorney backing to many of our criminal cases from our law enforcement division. I wanted to add some real-life examples about the impact when we're not able to seek forfeiture of confiscated animals. Vicki Kittles is probably our best example of a cruelty case gone horribly awry and horribly expensive. Vicki Kittles had 119 animals in a school bus in Astoria, and unfortunately, Clatsop County had to be the one to find her, charge her with animal abuse and neglect, and then ended up caring for those animals for 2 years while Ms. Kittles worked the system. These animals had to be incarcerated because they are evidence and a crime. And what happened is those animals really got punished twice. They lived in a school bus under horrible conditions. They lived in a small shelter doing the best they can with limited resources, but any small shelter in Oregon, suddenly with 119 extra dogs, cats, chickens, it was an enormous fiscal impact for them, and those animals paid a dear price. By the time we got ownership and ability to find homes for them, they were really damaged animals. You could just set them on a table and they wouldn't move. You could turn them this way and they wouldn't move. They were petrified. 2 years in a shelter after years of living in that school bus. There was very little we could do for them. The homes we found for them, we had we got them together in a year's time. Those dogs were unchanged, sitting on their owners' laps, absolutely petrified. As we consider fiscal impact, and I know that's the word to watch, and I don't envy the legislature's job this year trying to patch together our budgets, I hope you'll recognize the extreme fiscal impact of housing animals all the way through a case, especially when we talk about fighting dogs. If we took in 20 fighting dogs, they would occupy 20 individual kennels that they would destroy in short order. These dogs got all the power and all the boredom and all the drive to do something bad, no matter if it's concrete, stainless steel, chain link, the physical cost of housing them, and then housing them individually for that length of time. Fighting cocks, nobody seems to have 5 or 6. They have 50 or 200. The largest case I worked on was 1,200 fighting cocks. They all want to kill each other. It's not like you can put them in the barn. It's not like you can put them in a pen. You'll have 3 big roosters at the end of the day. They require specialized housing. I'm sorry if I distracted you with that visual there. Yes. They require specialized housing. This bill allows us to impound on premises, give us a few days, sort it out, you know, perhaps find a more permanent solution to them. But there is no shelter in Oregon that can take on 300 fighting cocks and do it humanely and do it cheaply. I would argue that your fiscal impact statement probably doesn't roll in all the cost savings of moving these three crimes into the forfeiture statute. It is significant, and I'm here to talk about money, but I'm really here to talk about quality of life. Quality of life for the people who have to care for them, quality of life for the animals that have to endure this. The one amendment that perhaps is being considered is to drop sex abuse of an animal from being a sex crime. You know, it took two sessions to get that law put into place. I don't think anybody really wanted to talk about it. Nobody wanted to have a hearing. Nobody wanted to talk Thank about you. It. We finally got it in place. When these crimes come up, they're sensational. And the victims aren't the calf or the sheep or whatever else you're thinking that bestiality is. It's women and children who are forced to participate in these crimes. The people who do this, they're sick. They're not just old farm boys. These are sick people. And the next time one comes up and somebody does something, and what's our excuse? Well, there wasn't a law. He didn't have to be registered as a sex offender. If he's got five times more chance of recommitting that offense and his next victim is a person, I'd like to be the one at the front end saying, you know, we recognize this is a serious crime, and we need to keep him, keep track of him, keep monitoring him. That's got to be a lot cheaper than reoffending and throwing him in jail again. That's really my two cents, well, really the whole nickel on the bill. I hope you'll support House Bill 2529.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Representative Krieger?
Hey, Jim. Mentioned the bestiality bill. I was sitting where Representative Olson was my freshman year, and we heard that. Joanne Bowman was where Representative Stegler was. You know, I've been out in the world a while, have a farm, but we talked about things, and I kept getting lower and lower in the chair, because I never heard things discussed in a public place with women present about some of the things that were discussed. And Joanne Bowman, she hit me on the leg and says, you know, make a comment about, you know, the real world, you know. So I understand what you're talking about, because we discussed things that, you know, I never heard about, and I was raised on a farm.
Representative Barker, Representative Krieger, please do not go to any of the websites. Please do not. You'll be horrified at what you see. And not only that, you'll be spammed forever.
Mr. Chair, if I might make one other comment.
That
awkward silence.
I would really like to hear one of our freshman male attorneys
yes.
talk to us about it.
Representative Garrett could answer, speak to this, I'm sure.
I just wanted to make a point. In the case that I referred to in Southern Oregon that recently occurred involving bestiality, the basic facts of that case involved a person from outside of the United States offering five figures, over $10,000 per act, for people to engage in videotaped conduct with animals that this person could then sell on the Internet to subscribers in the Netherlands, if my memory serves, and make a substantial profit. And so there is a for-profit motive here as well, in addition to and perhaps amplifying the perverse nature of the conduct in and of itself. So.
Was he a Republican?
Just kidding.
Thank you.
That's a matter of public record. Yeah.
Thank you very much for your testimony and for your questions.
Your next campaign.
I'm sure it wasn't. That's why I asked. Mr. Buchholz.
Representative Wisnett, that's why you're down there. Yeah. I'm way over here.
He's here to watch you. I apologize.
I don't believe that was said out loud.
My temp is humor.
A little light over there. All right.
Yeah, kind of a tough subject.
Dear Chairman Barker and members of the Oregon House Judiciary Committee, my name is Tom Buchholz, and I'm here to talk about the real world today. We have Washington County Ordinance 604. It says, after obtaining a search warrant in a manner authorized by law, an animal control officer, peace officer, or any combination may enter the premises where the animal is being held. Jackson County, 612.02. Animal control officers are code enforcement officers as described in 203.10. Animal control officers are designated as peace officers as that term is defined in 161.015. As it pertains specifically to the authority provided under sections 1 and 2. We have the Bend City Code here. Any member of the Bend Police Department, including community service officers, may apply to the Bend Municipal Court for a warrant authorizing the search and seizure of any animal. Since 1885, search warrants have been required in cases of cruelty to animals. Prior to 1973, some peace officers, by implication, were clothed with the power to do all things necessary to bring about the apprehension and conviction of criminals. Other peace officers have had clear statutory authority to serve and execute search warrants of arrest and warrants of search and seizure. This is the Liquor Commission. Since 1953, they've had it. But this all changed in 1973. The legislature had a committee that had a proposed Oregon Criminal Procedure Code, the final draft. If you look on the back here, you'll see that the word peace officer is defined under 133.005, and it's defined as a member of the state police, a sheriff, constable, a marshal, a municipal police officer, investigator of the district attorney's officer, an investigator certified as a peace officer, okay, and an investigator from the criminal justice. The one for search warrant, though, is not a police peace officer. It's a police officer. And it's defined as a sheriff, municipal police officer, member of the Oregon State Police, investigator of the district attorney's office, or investigator from the Criminal Justice Department. My concerns are that there's a lot of people getting search warrants that shouldn't be. And I really don't know why the city of Bend or the county of Washington County or the Jackson County or any other county, because you don't know until they come online. It's really hard to research all this stuff. Why they're writing procedures for search warrants when it's definitely, you know, a state job, apparently. The Attorney General's opinion 7077, it was dated 1974, they're talking to the OLCC. He says that the opinion stated that under Oregon laws codified as ORS 133-525 and 133-545, a search warrant may be applied for by a police officer and not by a peace officer. Similarly, the warrant may be executed only by a police and not by a peace officer. In 2007, Senate Bill 343 provided that OLCC officers and investigators were peace officers for the purposes of certain laws relating to law enforcement. This bill went on to change all references to police officers back to peace officers, changing back about 35 years of law. This bill did not pass the legislature, at the end. The bill is just another piece of the puzzle that could lead to only one conclusion. Search warrants may be applied for and executed only by policemen. The Attorney General's 1999 search and seizure outline asked the question, who may apply? The question given, the application for a search warrant may be only made by a district attorney or any police officer. Page 223, the question was asked, who may participate? The answer was given in ORS 133-575, which permits warrants to be executed only by a police officer. It does allow for people to have other people with him, though. The May 14, 1999 letter from the Department of Public Safety and Training states that ORS 133-545 states application for a search warrant may be only made by a district attorney or by any police officer. The letter goes on to state Finally, the current criminal law curriculum is designed to familiarize recruits with Oregon criminal code. Recruits are frequently required to find answers to and by digging into the Oregon criminal code and reading the law. After reading this letter, my concerns are that in ORS 167.345, the statute ORS 161.015 needs to be replaced by the search warrant and seizure statute ORS 133.525. The term a police officer in 167.345 needs to be changed to police officer to comply with Oregon State Chapter 133 as who to may apply for and execute search warrants. These changes will give the recruits and police police officers the correct answers when they are required to dig into the Oregon Criminal Code to read the law. I'd like to read just a couple more letters here. Just in 1991, I had a Multnomah County Animal Control officer. I had two police officers and a Multnomah County sheriff in my yard. My animal was taken without a search warrant. The animal was given, didn't languish in Multnomah County because they only give you 144 hours to kill the dog. That's under not their code, but it was under a customary, or it was found in their operation manual, not in their county code. I have a letter here that says, in response to your questions concerning the procedures for obtaining search warrants, this is from the Multnomah Animal Control, who I had to deal with. I didn't get to deal with the police officers or the sheriff. Search warrants can be obtained through a district attorney's office or by going before a Multnomah County district judge. We have used both methods with equal success. Search warrants are not required in situations of emergency animal rescue. Then, that's 1994. In June 7th of 1995, from the Multnomah County District Attorney, I asked the question why a local police agency had not had occasion to obtain a search warrant for the removal of animals. The answer I got was, I would assume that in many of these situations, the police agencies defer directly to the animal control officers who have the primary responsibility for these functions. Well, I continued to write to them. And in May 1st of 2000, I got one from Mr. Schrunk's office. It says, Mr. Schrunk has referred this letter of April 17, 2003 to me. In response to your first set of questions, a police officer must apply for and execute a search warrant. There is no prohibition to an animal control officer being present during the execution of the warrant. So what I ask today is that in this bill that those statutes be changed and the word police officer inserted in the proper places in ORS 167.345.
Thank you. We'll certainly take a look in that. It's my understanding, though, that those terms, police officer and peace officer, are frequently interchangeable.
They are, if you're talking about Chapter 133, sir. But 161.005, they have at the very bottom anybody else designated by law. And the problem there is that evidently these counties and cities think that they can designate the people.
Okay, we'll look into that. We're not going to move the bill today because we don't have a fiscal, so we can't send it out as a bill. So before we do, we will certainly look into that. I'll have committee's attorney do some research on that so we get.
I know I was talking to my representative, and when I said I wanted to change the police officer, she said that the sheriff does it in our place, I kind of just put it on her really fast because I wanted to get in before Monday because, and I really apologize to Senator Schrader, or Representative Schrader, excuse me.
He's Senator, you're right.
Senator Schrader, yeah, because I really did lay it on her. But I got to thinking about it, you look at the word police officer and you think it's just a police officer, but it really is a lot of people. But it doesn't include anybody else by law. I mean, I think the state of Oregon tells you who can get it, and that's what I'm here for.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your testimony. Is there any questions? We will research that.
Thank you.
Okay, and then we do have an amendment, so I'll close the public hearing, open a work session for the purpose of considering adoption of the Dash 1 amendments to the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move adopt Dash 1 into House Bill 2529.
Representative Wisnett moves the Dash 1s into House Bill 2529. Is there any discussion, any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. And closing the session on House Bill 2529.
Yeah, that one
or
these two.
Yeah. Okay, I guess. Open a work session on House Bill 2317.
House Bill 2317 was first heard on January 21st. This requires the Oregon Lottery Commission to notify the state court administrator of any lottery winner who has a delinquent account. It requires notice before releasing any prize greater than $500. It prioritizes delinquent child support obligations over delinquent court obligations. It declares an emergency. There was no amendment to this. However, we do have two rather comprehensive statements, one for revenue and one for fiscal.
And what do they show?
They show that there is revenue generated and that there's also a fiscal cost.
Do they offset?
They do offset. I believe we have... do you want to come up? What I see on this is that the revenue offsets now the fiscal by quite a large amount, but I think perhaps we can have representative here from the lottery.
Hi, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm senior staff counsel in the Office of the State Court Administrator.
Yeah, we were curious about the fiscal.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the fiscal is essentially what we thought of what it would have been last session. It's fairly similar to that, and fiscal continues to be what it is. Part of it will be funds that we have to pay to lottery to accomplish this because they can't use their own funds for that, and part of it will be programming costs we have to set up a system to make this work. The revenue forecast, our projection on the revenue was about $375,000. The Legislative Revenue Office disagrees with us. They're come down more about $275,000, but at that, we still get a gain of about $175,000 using this program. At least we hope.
Okay. Is there any questions? That's kind of fiscal. I like to hear.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. We are in work session.
We are.
The committee approve House Bill 20. Send to House Bill 2317 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnett moves House Bill 2317 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Barrett. Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Wilson.
Yes.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Yes.
Vice Chair Stigler.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries. Somebody like to carry that? Representative Garrett. How about jerking that? Okay, Representative Garrett will be the carrier. Close the work session on House Bill 2317 and open a work session on public hearing.
You're right.
Public hearing on House Bill 2489. We'll open a work session.
Work session. House Bill 2489 was heard on March 2nd. Actually, just on this last Monday, we have a minimal expenditure and we have no revenue impact and no amendment.
Minimal fiscal.
And this directs the Department of Corrections to work with the Department of Transportation to help people get their ID cards prior to coming out of incarceration to help them transition back in. Is there any discussion about that bill?
There's no fiscal on it?
Minimal.
Cool.
He likes that too.
No explanation.
Yeah, no explanation. So. Okay. and they're already trying to do some of that. So, any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
All right.
Do we have a motion? What are we voting on? Who made the motion?
I'll make the motion.
Representative Stigler.
I would move House Bill 2489 to the floor with a due pass.
I'm still back to the animals. Thank you.
You better be quiet.
You better be good.
Representative Bart.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Yes.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Stigler.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Whitman?
Aye.
Chair
Barnes? Aye. Motion carries. Representative Cameron, would you carry that?
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Karen.
Yeah. And open a work session on House Bill 2490.
Mr. Chair, I move the committee's pass 2490 to the floor, but I do have pass recommendations to the floor.
With that.
Is there any fiscal? Do you have any report on that? Or?
Minimal.
Okay. Representative Whiston has moved House Bill 2490 to the floor to do pass. This requires the Department of Corrections to provide certain documentation and evidence upon the release from prison. Any discussion? Representative Krieger.
Should go on the consent calendar if you get the right vote.
Cameron should carry this.
Yeah.
Yeah, Cameron should take a victory lap.
Cameron worked on these. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stigler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Whitman?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Motion approved. Representative Cameron, I would like you to carry that since you've done a lot of work on this bill.
Is that can you carry?
Yeah, I'll carry.
Thank you.
Either way, you want it on the consent calendar?
I'll get you some questions.
No, this will be good. Bill should pass.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, no further business come before the committee.
You could give me some questions.
You give me some questions.
No.